This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We've been talking about Alibaba, certainly a name that is front and center today. It's up about 14% as we speak, jumping. I think it's the biggest intraday climb since January. It all has to do with plans to split into six units. So we want to get to the news and the impact it's having on the overall Chinese names that trade here in the United States. With more on the news, let's bring in Bloomberg News equities reporter that follows the Chinese ADRs that trade in the U.S. Yishen Chen is here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Yishen, tell us about the news, first of all. I feel like it's interesting that Jack Ma comes back after missing for a year. That was yesterday. And then we get this news today. So walk us through the news and maybe the significance of it.
Yeah, great. First, thanks for having me today. And, you know, it's definitely a very interesting week for Alibaba. Today, the news is showing it's like a radical restructuring plan for Alibaba because it now is going to split the whole business unit empire into six individual units, including e-commerce, cloud, and also media. And it potentially paves the road for them to raise funds and eventually explore the IPOs of individual units.
So unlocks value, I bet investors see it as potentially.
Right. And I think it's more than unlock value because, you know, what analysts and investors are telling me is they see it as a win-win situation for Alibaba and Beijing. So first of all, it is for sure like unlock value for investors if you look at do like a math on the, you know, some of parts of each individual units is trading, like it should be way higher than currently where it is trading now. But also thinking about from the regulatory perspective is we all know that Beijing over the past 2 years have been having this sweeping crackdown on the tech industry. And the main concern was that, you know, the concentrated power of Alibaba and many tech firms is not helpful or healthy in terms of competition or innovation in the industry. So now that Alibaba, what it is doing is to break the big empire into pieces, so in a way that should potentially ease the concern from Beijing, from the regulators, and this is a move also should, you know, get the blessing from them.
And it's great to have you here, Yishen, because obviously you're one of our star reporters on the equities team. But I also know this is a rare move, right, when you're thinking about technology companies specifically based in China. So what do you think this means for the industry, and could it potentially be a template for other companies to follow?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I have seen analysts and investors saying this is a game changer for the industry going forward, and it could serve as a blueprint for other firms such as like JD.com, Tencent, or Baidu to explore similar paths. And Tencent could be the most reasonable candidate here for a breakup because it has huge influence just as Baba, and it has different business lines. It actually already started to divest some of the units, but still their remaining entities could become standalone segments.
Yishen, would Jack Ma have done this without the Chinese government kind of putting pressure on the internet sector? And I'm wondering if Alibaba was in the United States, would U.S. regulators, you think, similarly been saying we've got to push for a breakup? I'm curious what analysts, how they are weighing in on that, if they are.
I mean, I haven't seen enough reporting there, yeah. But it's a very good question. And I would say, since you brought up Jack Ma, I think it's interesting because this news today also coincides with the news we saw yesterday that Jack Ma was spotted back in China again after a year, more than a year of like traveling or staying abroad, right? The market, of course, took that also as a very positive sign because Beijing right now is pushing and saying that it wanted to support private enterprise to revive its economy, but it really needs to gain the confidence from the companies and investors after, you know, a series of crackdowns of different industries. So now that Jack Ma is coming back, and then with this split plan appear to, you know, pave road for, you know, the company's future, these are all like turning the sentiment of Alibaba, but also Chinese ADRs in general.
Yeah, they were all up today. Right. Or a lot of them were.
Yep. And I know you've also covered different calls, say like with Marco Kalanovic over at JP Morgan. He was talking about buying the dip on Chinese equities, in particular back even during right before, in early October, during that whole reopening type trade, and some of that had paid off. But are you seeing any other analysts kind of still calling for maybe still continuing to buy this, or do you think it's run its course? Because it's interesting if you're looking at the right as far as how they've performed so far this year, more broadly, kind of flat, not really. Yep, obviously, we saw that big rally in the fourth quarter,
right? Because on the JPM call, we were together on a story, Jess, and at that time, I think the call, the main thesis is about the reopening.
Right.
But remember that reopen rally we have seen from November last year have fizzled out a bit, especially after a quarter of, you know, like earnings print.
There's quite a bounce off of that low.
Right.
Of like casino stocks and hotels.
Yeah, also like travel related names. But it has already played out. So investors now are more at the point of they want to see what is the fundamental value of these companies. They are focused on the regulatory certainty and certainty. But this news definitely helped in terms of, you know, the regulatory perspective.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Ishan, because I do feel like depending on, I felt like we went through a period of, even we saw it with the pandemic, you know, shutdown, open up, like it was just kind of startling. And even with the tech sector, China has been very clear about wanting to be performing in the global economy on a higher tech level. Like this is important to the global growth and the growth in China specifically. But there's a lot of oversight about privacy and and data, you know, gathering. And I do wonder, does a move like this calm tech entrepreneurs in China and investors when it comes to investing in these names? Or is it a reminder that China and Chinese officials could at any moment be like, you know what, I still don't like how big this company is or the impact it is, and that they could move in? I'm just wondering if things are settling down in terms of that.
Right. I think that's a very good question. And back to the news here, I think one question investors are asking on today's news is where are like these potential individual units or spin-offs of Alibaba going to list? In Hong Kong or in China, the domestic market? Because ever since, you know, Didi's IPO debacle in New York, Beijing has been calling for the so-called homecoming listing of Chinese companies. So these are reasonable speculations that even they, you know, break up and eventually list some of the units, maybe they offer the shares or issue the shares closer to home.
So if they do that, what would
regulation?
I was just going to say, what kind of message does that send
to investors? Right, I think it's in line with where Beijing is pushing for more regulations in terms of the listing, share offering, and they also wanted to give access to domestic investors to own and trade on these, you know, national big tech firms.
So maybe no listings in the U.S. potentially.
Well, yeah, that. Yeah, we need to see.
No, but I just think it's really interesting in terms of the sector and how it's been playing out.
Right? Yeah. No, definitely. So really, we don't have a ton of details yet, right? As far as what the timetable could be moving forward on this, because I'm sure investors are itching to know.
Yeah. yeah. Like today is, I think, the first step in terms of splitting up and could potentially pave the road for a wave of IPOs. But we haven't seen any details in terms of timeline or, you know, what is the IPO plans for the individual units.
And still doing cost cutting to shore up the bottom line. So that's business as usual. Thank you so much. It's an important sector and love talking about those Chinese names that trade here in the United States. Yixin Chen, thank you so much. She's Bloomberg News equities reporter. She follows the Chinese ADRs that trade in the U.S., joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Looking at shares of Alibaba right now, still higher on the day, just off their best levels of the session, a gain of about 13.8%. And we did talk earlier about the NASDAQ Golden Dragon. That index also higher on the day, largely because of the moves that we saw in Alibaba. That index is up about 3.4%. So definitely that whole sector, as we talked about earlier, definitely some outperformance.
Definitely, for sure. And something that investors are definitely going to keep their eyes on, especially like we were talking about, as far as when it comes to even with these Chinese-listed U.S. stocks in the U.S., how they've been outperforming at last quarter, but obviously underperforming this year.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Jess, here's some startling statistics about one profession. For those in it, some 46% would not recommend it as a career. Only 33% feel fairly compensated. 93% think the shortage in their field will only get worse. So those are pretty rough numbers.
They are. And when I know what profession you're about to talk about, and this is something that was pivotal, especially, it always is pivotal, but especially in the wake of the pandemic.
Absolutely. We're talking about nursing, which, as you said, we were reminded was so crucial to get us through the COVID pandemic. So let's get more on the state of nursing. Great to have back with us Dr. Iman Abuzaid. She's CEO and co-founder at Incredible Health. Her company connects hospitals with nurses and other healthcare workers. She joins us via Zoom from Austin, Texas. Dr. Abuzaid, nice to be checking in with you again. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, so listen, I shared with our audience and viewers some of those statistics. Tell us about your State of the Nursing Report, which I believe was just released today.
Yeah, it was released today. It's our fourth annual report, and we use hiring data from over 700,000 nurses in our network on the Incredible Health platform, and then we surveyed an additional 3,000 too. So as far as just the main findings, I'd love to start off with just some good news, actually. There's been some improvements since last year. So 80% of nurses plan to stay in their field until retirement, which is a big increase. It was only at 55% last year. And then there's also been a 10% decrease in the number of nurses who are planning to leave their current roles this year. So that means that turnover will hopefully be improving in the next 12 months too.
Can we ask you why that good news? Why do you think those numbers have improved? Because I know they were pretty dismal when we were talking to you before.
They were. I think the main reason is that the pandemic and the intensity of it has subsided a bit. And then we're also through the tridemic. You know, there was this RSV flu time period too. Nurses are a little more optimistic about the long term and the future, their future careers.
There was a nurse in my neighborhood, a neighbor who she was like, I'm done. Wouldn't go, like, just because it was just too much coming at her. So I can totally relate. Walk us through some of the numbers, though, that weren't so great.
Yeah. No. So now, having said that, even with some of that good news, that's a little bit more longer term looking that they want to stay in their careers. In the long term, there's still a lot of frustration about what's going on currently with understaffing, with burnout, and with pay. More than 62% of the nurses say they're not hopeful for the next generation of nurses, and 46% would actually not recommend a career in nursing. When asked about, you know, staffing shortages, 93% of the respondents said that they are experiencing the nursing shortage getting even worse, over 70% have pointed to inadequate staffing being one of their top concerns.
What I'm wondering about, curious about as far as what could be done to help healthcare workers feel more supported.
Yeah, there's quite a bit that all of us can do. For the hospital executives in particular, they can definitely invest more in career advancement. That's more training opportunities for nurses, so they're encouraged to stay at their health system. There's also quite a bit more work that needs to happen with providing more flexible scheduling, so allowing nurses to pick not just full-time roles, but also part-time roles, and not only 12-hour shifts, but also 4-hour and 8-hour shifts, and weekend shift options, just so they can fit work into their lives a little easier. And then, you know, there, of course, like the other big trend that we're seeing is with wages. You know, wages has increased overall. We're seeing a 14% increase in sign-on bonuses, in the use of sign-on bonuses overall, and the actual amount of sign-on bonuses has also increased.
Was that ever a thing years ago? I had a sister who was a nurse. I don't remember her ever talking about a sign-on bonus.
It wasn't a thing at all. We've also seen the actual hourly rate increase. I think the reason it's become a thing is because you know, there's a huge supply shortage here, right? Yeah. There's a huge supply-demand imbalance. And as a result, because we don't have enough workers, wages will go up.
So as far as kind of piecing all of this together, are there more nurses that are planning now to actually stay in this role a year from now versus obviously before, because you were explaining all of those statistics now? So if they are planning to stay, does that potentially bode well?
Yeah, it bodes well that they're more likely to stay. Now, keep in mind, the turnover is still high, right? The turnover annually is at 22%. But thankfully, a much smaller percentage of nurses are looking to leave the field altogether.
You know, one of the things that I remember, Dr. Abu-Zaid, from I think we talked last time, what's the average, I hate that word, what's the average nurse make? What's the average salary in nursing?
It's about 93,000 nationally.
Okay.
That's a national average. Obviously, it varies dramatically by state.
Yeah, no, right, lots of variations. And I know we've talked about, as you said, there's not necessarily a lot of people coming into this profession. Once again, is it, you know, opening up immigration? And I know we've talked about this in the past. Is that the fix? What's the fix in terms of encouraging people to enter in? I often find that it's a lot of people from other countries that are in nursing.
So there's two key bottlenecks that are happening in the U.S. Number one is at nursing school. So there's tens of thousands of Americans on wait lists to get into nursing schools, but the nursing schools cannot handle more capacity. And so we need to expand nursing school capacity in this country and train more nurses. And then there's another bottleneck happening right after nursing school, in that there's not enough programs at hospitals and other employers that train nurses to become more specialized. And so both of those are the two huge bottlenecks that we have.
Just got about 30 seconds. We've talked with you about this before. Any progress that we're making on this? Are you seeing it?
Not yet. It's not showing up in the data yet. But I know that many nursing leaders and HR leaders and nursing education leaders are actively working on it.
They have to be stressed out, because if you think about an aging population, we're all going to just need more of certainly healthcare services overall, but definitely nursing in particular. Iman, good to check in with you again. Dr. Iman Abu-Zaid, she's co-founder and chief executive officer at Incredible Health, joining us via Zoom from Austin, Texas. I mean, I think about it, right? We just know that an aging population is just going to need a lot of healthcare going forward. And you do wonder whether the doctors will be there, the nurses will be there.
Absolutely. But then hearing about the wage gains, signing bonuses, will that be enough to continue to get workers in that field?
As long as the pool of workers are there. All right, you're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com. stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Okay, I'm just going to say it. This is one of my favorite stories of the day. It's one that will be in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands later on this week, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And it's, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's about how China has become the lender of last resort for developing countries. Why you should care, because it has lots of implications geopolitically and more. With more, let's head to Washington, D.C. That's where we find Sean Donnan. He's Bloomberg News senior economics writer. He is on Zoom. And then in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, we have Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. Joel, I feel like China's involvement around the globe, especially in the developing world, has grown a lot. We know a lot of it by way of its Belt and Road Initiative. This story by Sean, though, takes it up a notch.
Yeah, and it actually looks at sort of the soft power. And you're right about this epic project building spree that China's been on. This is a little different, and it actually shows that basically China's been in a quiet little fight with IMF. And and the amount of money here is really the crazy part. So Sean, how did you find this story, and what stands out to you about these numbers?
Yeah, look, this is really the result of some really great work by some economists at an outfit called Aid Data, which is at William & Mary in Virginia, the World Bank, the Kiel Institute in Germany, and Carmen Reinhardt up at Harvard, who's one of the world's leading experts on the kind of history and politics of debt and their impact on crises. They did this amazing work where they dived into really central bank records and other records around the world and identified this $240 billion that had been loaned out by China over the last 20 years to 22 countries. And these are 22 countries in the developing world. And this is a different kind of lending from China, in that what we've grown used to is China financing big infrastructure projects like ports in the developing world. This is actually what we would call rescue lending. These are bailouts to countries that have gotten into trouble and to their central banks to try and help them ride out crises. And that takes China into a whole different area of lending, and as you say, starts to establish it and its central bank as a lender of last resort in the global economy and a potential rival to institutions that have been around since the end of World War II, really, like the International Monetary Fund, and that have become the normal way that we respond to crises.
So you write that exact comparisons are difficult, but China's $185 billion surpassed the $144 billion disbursed by the IMF over the same period. What period are we talking, and why is it so difficult to compare?
Yeah, so look, the IMF gives out concessional emergency loans with a lot of conditions attached requiring reforms. The type of lending that we're talking about in this period, which is between 2016 and 2021, which catches the lead up to and the first couple of years of the pandemic and some of the economic turmoil that we've seen since then, the type of lending you get from the People's Bank of China comes via these swaps to central bank reserves, and it sometimes comes from state-owned banks with higher interest rates and different tenures. The kind of terms of lending are difficult to compare, and that's what we're talking about there. But the total sum that we're talking about there, and this is the amount that's drawn down on credit lines rather than the amount that's committed by either China or the IMF, means that the $185 billion that China sent out over that period to these 22 countries, remember, is comparable to the $144 billion that the IMF sent out, dispersed to member countries that were dealing with various economic crises in the same period.
Okay, Sean, so what kind of countries are we talking about here? And what do we know about why they've needed it and turned to China?
Yeah, so look, we're talking about countries like Pakistan, we're talking about countries like Argentina, Sri Lanka. We're talking largely about the poorer countries in the world and countries that have run into debt problems over the years. Some critics would charge that a lot of those debt problems have come as a result of Chinese lending. In fact, that's what the Biden administration and previous administrations would claim. This kind of this incredible flow of funds that's come out through the Belt and Road Initiative into the developing world to help build infrastructure, sometimes at terms that were, in hindsight, maybe too generous or irresponsible. And these are debts that have built up. And as we hit the pandemic and as we hit the turmoil, a lot of countries ran into trouble and they want to bolster their foreign exchange reserves. They need to bolster their government budgets to try and ride this stuff out. In the past, these are things that they would go to the IMF for other lenders.
Sean, I want to jump in. How much of it, too, is about the Chinese currency? Because we know that the Chinese would love for the Chinese currency to be the world reserve currency and not the US dollar. And they've tried to kind of put it out there.
This is all about influence, right? And currencies out there are about influence as well. This is about a great geopolitical battle. A lot of these swap lines that were set up by the PBOC over the last 20 years were set up with the idea of financing trade and getting the world to use the Chinese currency, the renminbi, a lot more. But in what we've seen in this case and what they really document in these studies is that these swap lines that were set up for that purpose, in fact, ended up being used for kind of emergency rescues. And in some cases, you know, ended up as dollar funds going into the foreign reserves or being transferred into dollars and kind of, you know, bolstering the dollar system in a way, in a funny way. The whole game here is really, you know, when we talk about the U.S. and China and growing rivalries and this Cold War, we often focus on the trade wars or the battles over technology and things like semiconductors. Well, this is a whole other side that we really need to start paying more attention to, and that's debt and what is happening in the world, where a lot of poor countries are getting into increasing problems and they need rescues. And here's China riding to the rescue alongside the International Monetary Fund and some of those U.S.-led or U.S.-backed institutions that have been the traditional responders.
And Sean, when you're talking about these swap lines, obviously when we think about the Federal Reserve, it's so crucial when they have this to obviously prevent liquidity problems. And they've done some measures in the last few weeks with other central banks to expand the frequency of that. But when we're talking about China's currency swap agreements, kind of set us up and how exactly could all of this play out? And what's different about this compared with when you're looking at these other global central banks?
Right. So, I mean, the Fed swap lines are with a fairly, they've become this crisis response tool since the 2007-08 global financial crisis. But they're with a pretty limited set of central banks. These are largely rich world central banks, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and so on. And they're really about getting emergency liquidity into the dollar system. They're also incredibly transparent. You can go onto the New York Federal Reserve's website and you can look at individual transactions and who has drawn down and the tenor of those transactions, the interest rate that's being paid. The Chinese here are doing something different. They're using these swap lines as more traditional or different kind of rescue loans. And look, their defenders say, and they're doing something that's needed in the world in that they're helping out these central banks in developing countries. These are central banks that don't have access to the Fed swap lines, and they're helping them at times when they really need help.
Hey, Sean, is this, though, in essence, perhaps really a Chinese bank bailout?
Well, that's the suspicion of the authors. And Carmen Reinhart and I had this fascinating interview in which she says, look, I think part of this is the PBOC bailing out Chinese banks that got into trouble as a result of Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative that ended up with these bad loans in developing countries. And if you look, there's a correlation between where these swap lines are being drawn down and the bad debts that are out there for China, or the high levels of indebtedness to China. But she also says she can't prove that. Then again, she also says it doesn't matter because money is fungible. And if you get money in central bank reserves, that frees up money elsewhere on government balance sheets. It can help governments use or bolster budgets and the overall economic position in a country.
So the U.S., IMF, looking at this, suddenly they're number two or distant, more distant than that. How does this play out, Sean?
I think we got to watch. It's hard to watch because it's opaque. This is, again, the genius of this study is that they've told us about this. They've documented these sums. These are not things that we can look at easily on the PBOC website. And so we really need to watch and see where China establishes itself in the world and where it sends this money, whether it is just to bail out Chinese banks, in which case that's going to be something that wraps up in just a couple of years, or whether they're establishing themselves as a longer-term beneficent power that comes in to help rescue the world's poorer countries and does so for generations to come.
Well, it is kind of interesting, and I just think it just shows you how China is just playing on a very, very different level here, Sean, in terms of these markets, many of them that they're playing into in the emerging world. I mean, they have things that China wants to tap into, whether it's raw materials, raw minerals, if you will, and I just feel like the relationship becomes much more intertwined.
Absolutely. Look, as we said earlier, this is all about influence and geopolitics. We're going to be watching this for many years to come.
We talked about how this could potentially help out these poorer economies, but what would be the consequences for the global economy with this, given the nature of it?
Yeah, look, Carmen Reinhart is among the skeptics when she talks about helping out these poorer economies. You're providing money, but in some ways, one of the things we've seen with China is that they've been reluctant to restructure debts, to take haircuts on debts, to really ease the debt burden on a lot of poor countries. And we could get into a cycle where some of these countries just get stuck in debt traps, and that the Chinese, while they're funneling this money, they're keeping things ticking along. These countries may be paying the bills day in and day out, but they may not be getting out from under these debt piles, which drags on their economies, which has social consequences for their people, and may have consequences for people in the rich world as well, as we see. We've seen this at our southern border here in the United States, people from troubled economies in Central America coming north. And we could do the same out of Africa and other parts of Asia.
You mentioned Sri Lanka there, and that also exact example of that, where you have a stable country, stable economy, and all of a sudden it finds itself with, just astronomical amounts of debt that's also linked to China. When you think through some of those other names that we've rattled through here, Sean, are there any other ones that jump out at you that we'll be talking about who are linked in this same research?
Look, when it comes to debt problems that are very live and that people are looking at right now, it's Sri Lanka, it's Zambia in Africa, it's Ghana, where debt restructuring talks are just getting started. And then there's the one that gives a lot of people pause, and that is Pakistan, which obviously is a nuclear power, and it also has some incredible debt problems and some big Chinese debt problems that it needs to sort out in the years to come.
Hence what we said at the beginning, potentially this all has implications when it comes to geopolitics. Sean, great story, and a must read. Sean Donnan is senior economics writer at Bloomberg News via Zoom from Washington, D.C. Our thanks to him, as well as Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's in our studio. This story, by the way, it's going to be in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It'll be out on newsstands on Thursday, already on the Bloomberg terminal, but you can also find it at bloomberg.com/businessweek. Really, really important and certainly a sign of our times.
Definitely, and especially when we're talking about these currency swap agreements specifically with China and how that differs when you're thinking about these other central banks globally, it's really fascinating to see potentially how this plays out, as well as when we talked about these poorer economies that potentially need this help, but then also the potential consequences there.
I love how it's like kind of like a sly way to get everybody to use the Chinese currency. Right, Joel Weather?
Yeah, just, you know, hey, look at this. We have an app for that, too.
How did that happen? Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It drives me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, let's get to it. We've got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the trading day. Can we lower that? Thank you very much. All right, equities bouncing around. We're definitely off our best levels of the session, a little bit lower on each of those major equity averages, as you just heard from Charlie. Tech the most down on a percentage basis among those big three indexes. As for the two-year note, we're looking at it at 4.03, so staying above that 4% marker, right at it. Let's get to it. We want to talk a little bit about the fixed income world. Brian Allen is Director of Fixed Income at the institutional investment manager C.S. McKee Asset Management. They've got over $7.9 billion in assets as of the end of last year, based in Pittsburgh, and he joins us via Zoom from Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Brian, good to have you here with us. Right person to have, considering what's been going on in the financial markets. What do you make of the environment and your expectations for the fixed income world over the next 6 to 12 months? Do you have clarity, first of all, or transparency in terms of what comes next?
Well, frankly, no real clarity. Well, certainly the events of the last few weeks pointed out that we've come a long way with respect to Fed funds and general market interest rates, frankly, a little too high. The concern was always the Fed would raise rates until something broke, and it seems we've reached that threshold. We've had quickest move down in rates over a short-term time frame that we've seen in at least since 1987. So I think going forward, we may see one more rate hike from the Fed, and I don't expect to see the three or four rate cuts the market's discounting, but I think it's safe to say that the Fed will be done after another rate hike, and we'll wait to see what the ripple effects of the banking, not crisis, but concerns we have right now, how they play out.
Not a crisis.
Not yet.
Okay. TBD.
Brian, with all of this uncertainty that's swirling around, how are you advising clients to position in this type of environment?
For our clients in particular, we are very much quality and liquidity focused. That certainly will serve them well now. We have concerns about the rising odds of a recession and what that may do to credit, not only to the consumer or the borrowers, but the performance of corporate credit for our investments. One blessing in disguise from the spike in volatility we've seen is a deep discount and very attractive spread levels on agency issues that frankly now are yielding comparable to investment grade treasuries without the same economic cyclicality exposure that a corporate credit has. So
So it doesn't have the same type of risk there.
Well, you certainly have exposure to volatility, and a little more so than you'd find in corporate credit when you're just focused on market volatility. We've seen such a spike, though, we've now gone back, we've exceeded the level seen during first quarter of 2020 with COVID, and we were on par with the worst levels, the highest levels in volatility seen in 2008. So that really has cheapened those securities and made them very attractive. And the one thing you can bet, the Fed's obviously desire is to bring inflation under control, but to certainly do their part to establish liquidity in the markets and market function. And therefore, we think it's a safe bet that market volatility won't stay at these unusually elevated levels for too long.
Hey, what about real estate? And I bring it up, something just crossed on Twitter. This is from The Real Deal, which follows the real estate sector, but they talk specifically about debt on Blackstone buildings, 47% more than the portfolio's worth. This is coming from Moody's. The rating agency downgrades the debt, citing 11 properties, quote, declining performance. And they're just talking about a couple months after Blackstone secured a $271 million loan secured by 11 Manhattan multifamily buildings went to special servicing. So Moody's downgraded the CMBS debt, citing cash flow that wouldn't cover the debt service. How are you looking at real estate specifically, which we all keep wondering post-pandemic? Certainly here in the United States, a lot of people are still working from home. I look at a major city like New York, and there are still a lot of empty buildings. How are you looking at commercial real estate specifically?
It's a very small portion of the universe of the securities that we look at. In years past, certainly post-2008, we were very heavily invested because the valuations were sort of rock bottom at that point in time. I do have concern now about the elevated prices, one of the benefits or now risks that came from unusually historically low interest rates for so long. And the real concern, frankly, is not only the downgrades that have occurred to funds like BlackRock, but the refi risk when these bonds come, when loans come due, whether they can underwrite them at anywhere near the same value they had before. Certainly the terms won't be as attractive. And we certainly know the interest rate levels are much higher than they have been the last 3 or 4 years. So it's a challenge. And the office space historically was one that you could bet on. We frankly had concerns about 2020. It was really hotel space and anything travel and leisure related. But now the long-term effects, certainly one of the largest subcomponents of the commercial real estate market is office space. And it's, I think, you'd be very selective and look more towards suburban and Sunbelt properties than downtown New York, Chicago, some of the old...
Brian, can I just ask you, is it a manageable problem in your view, or maybe not?
Well, I think it'll take equity infusion, certainly. I think the properties continue to come back over time. I think places like New York do have a sort of migration problem, if you will. Certainly seen a number of Wall Street firms begin to locate some back office in Florida and in Texas. And then as the years have gone by, the last 2 years, joined by more of the sales side, trading side, moving out of New York, either again for tax reasons, weather reasons, certainly, and valuations in New York and in Chicago, I think will continue to be pressured. And there's only, I think, only so much conversion that can occur from office space into residential. And we've certainly seen that in Pittsburgh, but at some point, we've saturated the market with respect to new residential modifications to old office space.
Brian, we only have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, do you think the Fed should raise rates, pause, or cut rates at its next meeting in May?
About 50-50. I frankly think they want to send a message that inflation really is their first concern. They have to be, and they obviously are aware of what's going on in the banking world. I do think that ultimately, whether they do or don't, the message will be relatively clear that they're done, or at least on pause, after the May meeting. And again, I do think that the financial conditions indices they pay attention to, they've seen now credit card balances have gone up, loan delinquencies have certainly begun to rise, debt-to-income ratios on mortgages. There's definite signs that the consumer is tapped out and has really worked through the majority, if not all, of the excess income.
Well, it definitely feels like a sober tone or sobering tone. Brian, great to check in with you. Brian Allen, he's Director of Fixed Income at C.S. McKee Asset Management, based in Pittsburgh, but joining us via Zoom from Jacksonville, Florida.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.